Now, we have been seeking to find a practical, functional answer to the question, what is a group? We have discovered that a group is comprised of people. A group is congealed by virtue of purpose. That purpose must be clearly understood, and it must be personally embraced. Now, today we want to look at the third major distinctive of a group and its procedure, namely participation. We have said that a group is people moving down a pathway of interaction to a purpose or a goal. And I think we can visualize that in this way. Over on this side, we have the first element, namely the people involved. That's where we begin. Over here, the purpose or the goal. That's where we're moving. That's the target. And between these two is a pathway of interaction which involves participation. And I like his visualization, in which on one turn he has slow, on another the danger of a detour, and over here, sharp hill. Because that's exactly what you face in developing a pathway of interaction through participation. Now, I want to begin, first of all, today with a basic principle, then look at some phases of training, and finally, some techniques for getting participation. Let's nail down in our thinking a basic educational principle with a lot of evidence behind it, including strong biblical support. This is the principle. Learning is most effective when the person is active and meaningfully involved in the process. Learning is most effective when the person is active and meaningfully involved in the process. He is a participator, not a spectator. He is active, not passive. He is not on the outside of the group looking in. He's on the inside of the group working out. And to me, too much Christian education today is passive. And it is well expressed in the little poem, "Ram it in, cram it in, students' heads are hollow. Slam it in, jam it in, still there's more to follow." This exciting process of transferring notes from mine to yours without going through your head or my head. Met a student the other day in the hallway. He was on his way to an exam. I wanted to communicate with him. He said, "Prof, I'll see you later. Don't touch me. I'll leak everything I know." Budding scholar. He's in the process of Budaking. B-U-D-A-K. Five things he has to remember. B is the first one. U is the second one. He gets the Budak in his mind, runs around, goes into the exam. There it is. That's the question. Writes down Budak quick on the paper. And then he fills it out, turns it in. We give him an A. He's a scholar. We give him the same exam 2 days later. If he made a 30, he would be brilliant. So much of our education has forgotten that the process is as important as the product. That's real simply stated, but it'll take some doing for you to believe it. You still feel compelled to give people all the answers instead of taking them through the process. Now, with this underlying educational principle, I'd like to share with you and identify for you the major phases of any training experience. So let's see if we can visualize this for you to help you remember. The first phase of training involves telling. A person needs a given set of facts. He needs certain information. And we tell him these facts. We give him this information. The interesting thing is, this is where most education ends. The next phase involves showing. You tell him what's involved in personal work. And this develops a tremendous personal worker, doesn't it? Haven't you found this to be true? I've often wondered if a guy would even recognize personal work if he saw it. He should have a good demonstration of what good personal work is. But the third and crucial phase involves the doing. And this has to be broken down into two divisions. First of all, you give him a contrived experience. That is, it's controlled. It's a mock situation. It's a situation in which he can fall flat on his face without losing face. So that's why we're here. You fail. No, that's not failure. That's a part of the process of learning. Oh, that's good. That's right. Tremendous. It's exciting to see people fall on their face. Isn't it? You know, my girl has taken violin lessons. She took them from the second-year violinist of the Dallas Symphony Orchestra. And this guy gives recitals. You know, I found something very interesting in the recital. It's amazing. He never plays. Isn't that interesting? I mean, he never comes to the recital and says, "Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to play for you to show you how well I can play." I don't care how well he can play. I want to know how well Barb can play. You know what we're doing? We're putting on recitals in which we get up and play. See, the joy of a teacher is what his pupil does. And I've caught that guy's eye so many times as he sits there in the back and he's just beaming. You see this little gal with a cadenza and the rest of it, boy, going through it, and he's just in his glory. And this is the fulfillment. This is the test of his teaching, not how well he can play, how well those kids can play as a result of it. That's why most of us don't know what to get excited about. We're excited about the wrong thing. We're excited about what we're doing instead of about what they're doing. Exciting thing is to see a guy get up and he's going to give a presentation and he grabs it and he falls all over himself and he gets the application up at the front and he forgets half of it. It's terrific. I just peeped in here with George and his terrific song leading class. You know the terrific value of this? Get you up to do it. So you... No, not quite. and you go over it and over it until finally you can beat out a little time. How? By somebody getting up and saying, friends, let me tell you how to lead singing. No, nor even by saying, let me show you how to do it. But by you getting up and doing it under a controlled situation, which we can stop the music right in the middle and say, hold it. See, and everybody doesn't come unglued to say, tonight when we get in the meeting at the banquet, hold it, hold it. That's bad. Got to work that one over. You don't stop there. You just start there. The next phase is a real life experience. This is where failure can be costly. That's why you prepare him for that with this. So that you can reasonably predict what he's going to do out here. Because you've seen him in action. See, I know what he's going to do. Now, he may fail. But I have a reasonable assurance that he's been down this road enough time that he can succeed. I have taken, I counted them up, 5 courses in personal evangelism. You know, that's enough to qualify anybody. Not a one of them did it. And I got A in all of them. Give you the typical pattern. Class A. Over on this side, all of the objections. Memorize them. We memorize them. Over on this side, all of the scriptures. We memorized all the scriptures. They never had any practical program, so we went into Union Station in Chicago for a little practice. And the first bird I sit down next to brings up an objection that's not on that list. You know, there's a remarkable thing that I have discovered, and that is I have never yet seen or heard of a correspondence course in swimming. Have you? How do you learn to swim? Read books about it? No. Watch pros go up and down in the pool? And you watch them for years and sink like lead. Might help to read. Might help to watch the form of a pro. But friend, someday you got to get in the water. How do you learn to swim? By swimming. How do you learn to speak? Not by sitting on that chair, but by speaking. How do you learn to do personal evangelism? By doing personal evangelism. Under the supervision of a person who tells you what you need to know, who's able to demonstrate it for you, perhaps take you along with them so that you can see it in action. Then who sets up a contrived experience and we bring up 2 people, one of whom is the Christian, the other whom is the unbeliever, and we get all hung up. And he stops in the middle of it. It folds, runs out of gas. What in the world do you do now? Well, we haven't lost anything. We just turn to the scholars out here and say, what do you do now? And they don't know either. So we're really in business now. We got a crowd of believers on our hands. Tremendous learners. We continue to do this till finally we take them down to Colorado Springs. We go out to the base. We go over on the campus. You know, the thrilling thing about this type of thing is to take a person along. You tell them, look, you watch me for a while. You listen to everything they say, you listen to everything I say. And the interesting thing is they've been down this road. They know what you've told them. They've seen you do it. They've gone through the experience themselves. Now they're watching you even in a real-life situation. And they start to bug you. Say, hey, let me take the next one. Okay, you try the next one. So they get in the middle of it and get all hung up. And you know, they keep looking over. And go, hello?
Oh, that look. I wish I had a camera every time a student looks to me to bail them out, and I just sit there. You know, you can see him. Whoa, and I go, ah. Boy, and I've had him sweat. I've had him break out in a rash. I've had him go through all kinds of things. Well, boy, did they learn. Boy, when a guy comes through an experience like this, believe me, he's ready. I had a boy. We get him all the time. Educated beyond his intelligence. Particularly in the area of counseling. I mean, he had all the answers. He was sitting there, you know, next problem. So, I'm working out at the juvenile department with the city of Dallas, and we got a guy out there, 14 years of age, billed on 26 major counts of juvenile delinquency. State just waiting for him to grow up to put him away permanently. So I called my friend out there. I said, hey, I'm gonna send a scholar out to you. Got the answers. I want you to turn him loose on this kid. Got it? Got it. So I send him out. Boy, he gives him the royal treatment right down the road into this kid's cell. This kid's sitting in the cell with his feet propped up on a desk like this, facing the other direction. And when this guy comes in, he turns around and he says, hey, what's your line? Every day they send somebody else in here with a different line. What's yours? Should hear the student tell it. Boy, prof, I lost it all right on the floor. You should have seen him when he came back from this experience. He chased me all over that campus. Said, you know where I've been? Said, sure do. You know what happened? I sure do. I tell you, I saw a guy come from way out here with all the answers. The guy sitting right up on the front finding out if I knew anything to bail out of a type of situation like this. This is the best technique. This is dangling. I hope you're using it with your teenager. It's terrific. Kid came home with a paper out. I said, Bob, watch the draw. Well, it's important. You don't watch that draw, friend. You're going to go to the cleaner. Yeah, I got it, Dad. Watch the draw, Roger. You know how much he lost in 1 month? $64. You ever throw a paper out for 30 days at 4 o'clock every morning and come to the end and make $1.29? You know what he said when I said, what happened, Bob? Got to watch the draw. Terrific. See, I can tell him, you know, year after year about it. Well, boy, to watch a kid come to the place where he gets hung in this type of situation may be one of the best things. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, how many you draw papers you draw, they count them, and you got to keep your records straight with this guy's records and make sure you're throwing that many papers, because if you're not, you're paying for it. It's always the paper boy that gets hung with it. He got hung, 60-something bucks. Tremendous learning experience. Man, has he watched it? Last month, he was short 10 cents. That is great. But you know what we do? Oh, watch it. Oh, what? Well, I see people out there every morning. You know what they're doing? They're throwing the rock. Pop's out there throwing it. He can't lose this thing. He'll be out throwing it when he's married, too. Now, techniques for getting this job done. And I want to give you something. For getting people involved, which you can both adapt and adopt. How to turn on a group. And I'd like to share with you some things we are currently using. And I would strongly recommend for you. First thing I would recommend is a more extensive use of audio visuals. And let me spell this out for you. The greatest instrument you can invest in is a good tape recorder. Especially if you want to teach people how to function meaningfully in groups. Just put the tape recorder in there and let the thing go.
And these people run off and they get all hung up and the rest of it. And let them take it home and play it. So now you're trying to get across to this guy that when you talk to a group of people, you better think through how you're going to say what you're going to say. And furthermore, you better be mighty careful that you're not getting up and saying, there are some really very important things. So you can tell him this. But he says, what do you mean? I say, ah. Do you know that little machine? I love it. Because every time he says, ah, it says, ah. Now, I have a student that I'm trying to get across to him. Look, friend, you're a tremendous mortician. You're embalming like crazy. In fact, your voice is what I call a cradle voice. It just goes, da-dum, da-dum, da-dum. And it just facilitates people going out. I said, listen to this. So you put the tape on. You listen. Did you get the right tape, Prof? Look at the thing. Is your name? Gumball? Yeah. That's me. Say, friend, that's you. I put him in a little listening room we have, and the guy's out in 10 minutes.
You know where one guy came into my room? He came barging right through the middle of the door. He said, Prof, imagine having to listen to that. Oh, this has got all kinds of possibilities with this type of thing. Let me give you another one that we use it for. We were teaching the doctrine of salvation, trying to get a group of people turned on to understand what is the gospel, how to present it. You know what we did? We went down on the streets of downtown Dallas, and we conducted a man-on-the-street program by asking one question. How do you get to heaven? We asked 52 people. And out of 52 people, only one man stated the gospel clearly. One guy garbled it, and the rest of them were completely out of it. You know, this is in the quote-unquote Bible Belt. Everybody knows the gospel here. And we had a classic from a lawyer. You know the Old Testament? Well, frankly, I think everybody's going to heaven. It's like a mountain. We're all coming at it from different directions. You know, I thought this one was dead. This is a living, breathing lawyer in Dallas who puts this on. So we bring it into class, we play it. You think this guy knows what the gospel is? Suppose he told you that. How would you answer? See, this automatically brings an element of reality. I'm not talking to him about something that might happen. I'm talking to him about a guy that's talking right here. How would you answer? This is the guy you might meet on the street. The visual aspect, this overhead projector I'm sold out to. And I think the possibilities are terrific, and some of you have resource individuals in your group you ought to be exploiting to develop the kind of thing I've showed you here. You know what happens? You have a group. Your problem is to get people to take notes. You know the fastest way to get people to take notes? Get an overhead projector and put this on there. And I can tell you exactly the psychology of the group. Everybody says, hey, you got a pencil? And all over the place, you know, you see these people pulling it out. It's interesting to watch some of you. Fringe benefit of working here. Some of you remember Hal Brooks. He's a Southern Baptist pastor in Fort Worth. He came here to the Glen and really got turned on in terms of a number of things, and one of which was to get his people into the Word. So he invited me to come over for a series of four teaching setups on the book of Ephesians. So I said, okay, I'll tell you what. Can you get me an overhead projector? He said, sure, I'll get you one. So I got an overhead projector, and we started out. The first thing I did was to give him an overview of Ephesians. Now, mind you, this is in a church where they were not used to Bible teaching, where most of them didn't even bring the Bible. And the first thing you tell them to do is to turn to the book of Ephesians. No. Everybody looking around? So we put this thing up, and the same thing happened. Everybody starts moving for the thing, and they start taking notes. Second night, his leading deacon came up. He said, you know, very interesting presentation. He said, you know, you really have to have a Bible when you teach, don't you? He said, it really helps. Boy, old Hal was sitting up on the front. I thought the guy would go through the ceiling. Every night, we would double the number of people bringing a copy of the Scriptures. And they would be taking notes like crazy, and they'd be going home to read these things. What does it? Just put something down in a visual form, and a guy automatically, instinctively says, this is to be written down. And it's a good way to break a lot of people over in the process. A second technique I would suggest that you use more extensively is what we call buzz groups. And it's just as the name sounds. This is where it's valuable. Let's suppose that you got a group that they've asked you to come and speak to, and you got 40 people in the group. Now, it's very hard to have a discussion with 40 people. But there is one way you can do it, and that is you can break this thing down right in the middle of your session into about, I don't have this many, but let's say 8 groups of 5 in each. So you got 5 people in each of these little groups. I watched this at the seminary. I watched this in every conceivable situation. You come into a group like this, larger group of people, everybody sitting there, going through this usual routine. They say, all right, now, what I want you to do is to break up into groups. So I break them up into these little buzz groups, and I want you to answer this question. Break them up into buzz groups, and you look around and all over the place. See, it's real hard to keep quiet when there are only 5 people. Furthermore, to put it positively, it's a lot easier to talk. If you got 40 people, this guy won't squeak. Woo-hoo! But if you put 5 people, he'll talk. And the interesting thing is the moment you move to this and then move back to this to pull it out of them, you can immediately sense the difference in the dynamics of the group. Because everybody's involved. They're thinking. They got suggestions. In fact, your problem then is to turn them off. That's a good problem. That's tremendous. Always leave them longing rather than loathing. Much better to have them say, good night, I wish this thing had gone on for another hour. Man, you got it made. When they said, too bad this didn't quit an hour ago, wasn't it? You're in hot water. We use this very effectively, particularly with groups that we've never been with. Just cold turkey, walk in and break them up. And, you know, first time they begin to look around at each other, they're going to talk to each other. Third type of thing I would suggest is what we use the first day. Neighbor nudging. I use this with a large audience. I spoke to a group of people, about 3,000, and I got them involved by neighbor nudging. And you did just what we did. You get this person to speak to his neighbor. Just all over this thing. Now, this would be particularly good when you're in a church. You see, you can move these chairs so you can go into these buzz groups real easily, which, by the way, is a factor to consider when you are setting up a room, buying furniture. Can we move this thing around to create the type of environment we want? But you're in a typical church, and these are pews. They're odorous. See, they're nailed to the floor. Nobody moves. It's a little hard to get in a little group where you're trying to get over this way. So, you just get him to talk to his next-door neighbor. Now, I found a real good way, because sometimes you got one guy, this Niagara Falls individual, and this little neighbor nudging.
So the other person sits there while he gives them the hamburger and fan treatment. And he never talks. So what we do is I set up just a little watch up here and I say, now, I want you to talk to your neighbor and one of you speak for 2 minutes. And when I ring the bell, then the other person starts to talk. So that we're starting to control, you see, the fact that this guy's not going to monopolize the thing. I switch it back. I love this. A fourth type of thing that has terrific possibility, we call brainstorming. And there are books written on this, as far as the process, but it's really quite simple. This is particularly good when you are trying to get people to come up with ideas as to how to implement this truth. A couple of you have been asking me through the week, look, it's real fine. We come to the place of application, and then we run out of gas. Here's one way to get over it. Let me give you two I've used just recently. Copy down. Number one, how do you communicate your love to your child? I had a brainstorming session with a group of parents in Chicago the other day. What a time. Now, if you know anything about brainstorming, you know the purpose of it is to get as many ideas as possible. You do not evaluate. No critical remarks tolerated. You just give the ideas. You write them down as fast as they come. If I had sat down and planned to plant the contributions, I couldn't have come up with anything better. Typical ones are, wash and iron. Next one, keep the house clean. Number third, go to work every day. Oh, man, on like crazy. Tremendous ways to come through to your child that you love him. See, we put them all down like that, and then finally you get some guy coming in and say, fix the bicycle tire. Write it down. And we got a number of other things. And then we started to take it apart. What does this say to the child? You do his washing and ironing. To him, nothing. So we got to rule that one out.
You mean tell me I do all the washing and ironing and I appreciate it?
That's right. You know what he appreciates? I'll tell you what he appreciates, because he'll do it. You got a little kid in your house? He turns to you and says, Mommy, what's my name? Son, you are acting like your father again. He really is. He's very sharp. He's sharper than you are. He needs you. That's what he's telling you. He knows what his name is. He's not asking for information. He's asking for fellowship. He's asking you for a stop long enough to come down and say, Buddy Bob, terrific name. Oh, he thinks you're great. Whew. Boy, what a daddy. Tell you, it really gets through to you, my friend, as it did to me one day when I asked my boy why he loved me. And, you know, how philosophic can you get for eight? And half an hour later, he just whipped around and said, I got a reason, Dad. I said, wonderful, pal, what? He said, because you fixed my bicycle tires. See, my kids are not impressed by the fact that I came up here this week to talk to you. Isn't that something? You'd think they would be. Select group of individuals. Where are you going this week, Dad? Just think of it. My kids aren't even impressed that I'm a seminary professor. Imagine that. Back my boy said some time ago, Hey, Dad, when are you going to get a new job? So what's the matter? Don't you like my job? Nah. Why? Can't tell anybody where you work. They all think you work in a cemetery. And you see, the point is that you're trying to get this message across to them. Look, your kids are not impressed that you read your Bible and pray and do all of the nice, neat religious routines that you engage in. They're impressed that you got some time to spend with them. And when you have the time, you take it. Not, you know, going to the conference and saying, well, I'm supposed to play with my kids. Okay, let's go. Here we go. Come on, let's go. I'm in a hurry. Throw the ball right through the middle of him. You know what you're saying, Norm? 100 places I'd rather be than here. You know where you might as well be? Any one of 100. Sometimes you have to say to them, hey, buddy, I only got 5 minutes, pal. Nothing I would rather do than spend them with you. What would you like to do? Well, let's play ball, Dad. Great. When we go out and have a ball, man, and knock myself out and enjoy the thing, it's a good night. That's the fastest 5 minutes I've had. And a kid is smarter than the average adult because he understands. But he knows that when you got some time, you want to spend it with him. How do you get this across to people? Here's another one we use to show you this type of thing. I said to people, in a group, we're going to brainstorm to find out all of the reasons why people are happy in our world. Why they're satisfied. Oh, I thought like crazy. And then we went around, we put them up on a board. Came up with a list of 28 things in about 3 or 4 minutes. Went to Philippians 1. And there is not one of the 28 things in Philippians 1. By a man who knew what it meant to rejoice. So you got a group of people saying, good, well, what is it, this real happiness, satisfaction? You know, we came up with the boat and the house and all the rest of this. Oh, man, yeah, this is one we're using more and more. And a good way, by the way, to develop some of your people. And that's, we're using panels. Especially is this true where you are trying to get representative point of views. For instance, we had one recently on how to determine the will of God for your life. So you get a professional man on it, you get a housewife on it. We even brought a teenager into it. And boy, what a session we had. You talk about people involved, sitting here looking at real-life people, telling actually what they had learned. Now, the value was not only for them, but the people with whom they were sharing it. This is a good place for people to identify. And by the way, don't forget to use occasionally some reaction panels, especially if you bring in a resource individual, as I think I illustrated for you the other day. And that is, suppose you bring in somebody to speak to your group. I say, okay, I'd like you to speak for 25 minutes, and then we're going to have a reaction panel. We're going to set some people over, we're going to take notes, listen, and then they're going to fire away with questions to get us started. Here's one, role-playing. Please do not spell this R-O-L-L. You get this back on papers. Role, R-O-L-E. You are playing a role. Oh, some of you have asked me about things on husband and wife relationships, on living with teenagers, family problems. This is the most effective means I know of communicating. I just wish we had time to demonstrate some of these for you and particularly to use some of them with you. Because I would pull some of you right up out of the chairs, and I'd make one of you a teenager, and I'd make the other one the father. And we're going to set up the situation exactly what happens. Here it is, 5 after 12, and we told the kid to be home at 11. And he walks through the door. Now what do you do? And men are hanging on the edge of the chairs, listening. But you see, they're not emotionally involved. They're involved on the part of themselves. But you see, they can objectify this because it's just an acting situation. Now, if I get up and say, you know, the problem with you people is you don't trust your teenager. You know what they say? Shh. And tune you out. We get this type of situation, and then after they get through with it,
interesting thing is I get this guy that I knew was having real problems and this type of thing, and I made him the teenager.
Got it.
He came up for it. I'll be glad to take it.
Can I ever identify with that part?
Boy, he did. I sort of sense reality was coming through.
After we got through, and the thing, this guy came up to me, he said, "Friend, for the first time in my life, I know how it feels for a kid to come in and get scorched."
Because this other guy just took the hide off.
And I said, "You tell him that." "Oh, that's bad news. I don't like it." "But you do it in this form, it goes right down the center of the throat, and they enjoy it. Just like castor oil in orange juice. You know." "Terrific. Oh, yes. Boy, am I having a ball with this one. Now, you remember I told you there are different stages of development in a group. Don't use this one with the early stages. But debate. You are trying to get people to think. This is dynamite." I think back in my education, I learned more about how to think on a debate team than through any other technique. Boy, I remember the sweating times we used to have. We were debating Notre Dame one day. We were moving up, boy, and all of a sudden you walk in, you're sitting there, and you're not sure whether you're going to get the positive or negative, and you walk in and they drop it on you. You're negative. And you're on. And then we won the thing, and the problem was, then they switched it on us. So you got all this ammunition, that, boy, we got a winning team. So you walk in, you're not sure if you're going to come out negative again or not, and they drop it on you, positive. So you switch all of this stuff completely around the other side, but are you thinking? And I'm using this a great deal to get people to think for themselves. And by the way, this is a good way to get them to relate to people who don't agree with them. A very important thing in developing group work. Another thing that we're using, which I would recommend to you, is case studies. And as I was sitting thinking through some illustrations of this, it occurred to me that the NAVS would be a built-in place to use this. Because you have some pretty predictable behavior. In other words, you have some pretty good ideas of how people are going to react to such a thing as memory work. So I would develop a case study. Here's a guy's attitude. Here's how he started. Here's his progress. Now he's hung up with this problem. What are you going to do? Now the interesting thing is, you see, we're doing it in terms of some impersonal person who's got this problem. It's an impersonal situation. But he identifies with it for himself. So he's thinking through answering his own questions. The most thrilling illustration I saw of this was at the Harvard Business School. I was invited there by a friend to sit in on some of their new sessions in which they are developing in the Advanced School of Business Administration. Some fantastic approaches. The particular week I was there, they were studying a case study on a firm in Paris. I happened to be there for the Friday session and the Saturday morning session. They had been discussing all week the case of this firm over in Paris. And on Saturday morning, when he came into class and got started, the door opened and a little Frenchman walked in. He's the president of the company. They flew him over to Paris. And after these guys are going all the way around to find out how to do it, he says, "Let me tell you what we did." And then he went into an evaluation session. I used one of the most effective ones I've ever had the occasion of using by taking a guy that we had actually had a problem with and who had developed enough security that I said to him, "Would you be willing to share this with the group?" Well, he said, "I have to think about it." I said, "Okay." So he thought about it, prayed about it. He said, "Yeah, I would. I think it could be profitable to someone else." So I set it up as a case study.
We went around like crazy on this thing. Boy, what would you do? And this guy had this suggestion and thing. And I had this guy open the door and walk in. And everybody looks over, you know, who's that? He said, I'm the guy with this problem. And they started to work on it with him. And he said, no, that wouldn't work. I tried that. And then he had them so hung up that they were begging him when they finally caught on that this guy had solved this thing. How did you do it? But see, this is a lot different from somebody sitting and saying, oh, you know, 5 more minutes on it. One last thing, and that is the use of listening teams. See, one of your problems in this type of approach is that you're so emotionally involved in it, you can't see the forest for the trees. So what you do is take part of your group and constitute them a listening team. They do not speak. They just listen to what's going on. They evaluate. Well, you see, they're not emotionally involved, so they're sitting on the outside. They hear stuff they never heard before. And you write this stuff down. And after we're through, we go back to evaluate this thing. And to me, I think this boils itself down to one thing. And that's what a professor communicated to me so effectively. And that is, do you have a passion to communicate? See, I can hear some of you have already tuned me out because this is just too much work. And it's a lot easier to get up and run off at the mouth. This takes sweat. Real work. I had a professor, this guy used to work, man, I'd see him when I'd go down to the school at 5:30 in the morning working like crazy in his little upstairs study with his art lab that he had developed. Come by at night after I'd stay at the library till 10:30 or 11, he'd still be working. One day he invited me over to his home. I said to him, Doctor, I would certainly be interested to know what in the world is it that keeps you studying? He said, son, I have a passion to communicate. And I pace that floor at night asking the Lord, how can I get this across? He said, I have a paralyzing fear of boring a student. And then he said, I would rather have my students drink from a running stream than from a stagnant pool. See, from what will your people drink when you return to your area? The same stuff he notes? Same stagnant presentation? Or will you have developed a passion to communicate? May I say one thing as we wrap this up? There is a basic principle of communication that we cannot lose sight of, and that is you cannot impart what you do not possess. We can talk about techniques. We can examine methods. We can discern the process of communication. And it can all be very helpful, depending on whether you change. If you stay the same, you cannot communicate. And this is the reason why I've changed to prayer. I used to pray, Lord, change my children. And nothing happened. Until he finally broke through to me one day that I should begin praying, Lord, change my children's father.
I used to go down at the seminary as a result of this man's influence in my life, and I'd throw myself across the floor saying, God, help me. Help me to change the life of my students. And nothing happened. Until I finally started to get down on my knees and say, Lord, change their professor. And you know, the amazing thing, my friend, is when he started to change me, then I became a change element in the life of my students. And I think what you ought to pray before you get home is, Lord, overhaul this representative. Overhaul this team man, this contact, this area director, whatever you are. Because you see, when you get back, it's going to be quite the same as when you left it. It will not have changed. The question is whether you will have. And if you have changed, then you're going to be a change element back there. And you won't have all the answers. But if you have a passion to communicate, and you're teachable to say, Lord, just make me open. Make me available. Then he's going to pick you up, and he's going to pour his truth through you to the meeting of people's needs. And if he does that, then it will have been worth every bit of time that we spent together. If not, this is the most wasted week you and I have ever spent. I can only bring truth to your ears. The Spirit of God has to change your heart and life. And this he wants to do. Father, these have been such refreshing days, just the fellowship with people of like precious faith. We've been here on the mount, and the valley is below us, filled with people with desperate personal spiritual needs. Lord, we can't prolong our stay here. You haven't called us to that. We thank thee for the motivation, the instruction, the inspiration, the power of your word in our life. And we ask our Father that you'll so minister to us that then you may be free to minister through us. Lord, help us not to pray so much that you'll change our group and our area and our men, but that, Lord, you'll change me. And then through me, that you'll bring those supernatural miracles for which you have distinguished yourself and which you continue and delight to perform. We pray expectantly through Christ our Lord. Amen.